At this time, I'd like to turn the microphone over to our second speaker this evening, Peggy Kay.
Peggy? Hi, I am Peggy, and I am a grateful Al-Anon. I thank the good Lord that I married an alcoholic, or I'd have never found this group, and I'd never have the serenity that I have today. I met my husband in 41. No. It was 38 or 39 that I met him. My brother had a gold mine up in Georgetown, and it was called Tipton Hill. And in the September, they had the deer season, and I worked for the telephone company, and I always asked for my vacation so I could go deer hunting, never realizing it would be D-E-A-R instead of D-E-E-R. But I did go up there, and I met this. He was working with my brother. My brother had the gold mine, and my husband, Huck, came along, and my brother said, you know, would you like to be a partner in this? And he said, yeah. I had never met him. And so September we went up to go deer hunting, and here I met this gentleman. And so we did a lot of talking and walking, and he said to me one day, there's a place up above I want to take you so that you can see what people have done out here. He said, back in the early 1900s, this gentleman came out there, and he had built a home, and he had tiered the land so that he could grow vegetables and flowers. And to water that, he had a rope that he had a bucket, and he would drop it over the edge of the mountain down into the river and bring it up and water these things. And even though it had been many, many years, the asparagus was still growing there. And he was very taken with this, as the ingenuity of what had happened at that time. So on the way up, we were going along, and here comes this rickety old car down, and this gentleman stopped, and Huck stopped the car, and this boy's name was Tubby. He reached around, pulled out an old jug, you know, the old type, pulled the cork out, handed it to my husband. He took a drink, handed it back, and Tubby took a drink, and right then and there, I should have known I was in trouble. But I didn't, because I didn't know about alcoholism. But anyhow, that was the start of my learning of my husband drinking. And my brother also drank, but he was not the type to drink constantly. He'd have a few drinks and that was it. But my husband drank constantly, and then I began to wonder why. And at that time, I wasn't. We married in 1940, and he would drink, and I kept thinking it was my problem. I thought maybe I was lacking in something, that I wasn't giving him what he needed, that he needed to drink like that. But not knowing, I went along with whatever, and of course we had the problems that you have with alcoholism, hiding the jugs and me checking them to see how much. And then in December of 41, my husband was called. We had Pearl Harbor. Well, just before Pearl Harbor, he was called into service. And he made a career of the Army. And shortly after he was called in, my son was born. Well, he went into the service, and I went home to my mother. Thank God for mother and fathers. And they had a little apartment out in the back that was mine for as long as I wanted to have it. So I went home with my son, and my husband went into the service. And he was sent down to San Luis Obispo. And I went down there, too. And, well, everybody drank. I didn't think about it. The boys would come in, and this stuff was flowing all the time. And it never really bothered me until we had gone to Europe, and that was in 1955. That was 12 years later. He had progressed into that. and I had progressed subtly into my illness because I was not one to do a lot of talking or complaining. There was no alcoholism in my family, my parents. I had a brother, but he was much older than I, and his alcoholism never touched me. The only thing I can remember about that is one time that they were arguing, Mother and Dad was, and I heard Mother say to him, "What are you doing visiting that woman? She hangs her underwear out so everybody can see it." And, of course, my mother hung hers between the towels. You know, nobody saw them. And so you see, to her, this was a horrible thing to hang them out in the open. And that always stuck with me. That's the only thing I can remember about my poor brother ever having an argument with Dad and Mom about his drinking. And I assumed that's what it was for. I finally, when we went to, we were sent to Europe in 1955. And first of all, we went to Frankfurt. And I didn't really care for Frankfurt because it is a, if you walked, I was walking down the town one day and some great big old German fellow almost knocked me on my fanny. He shoved me as I went by. And of course, I wasn't a very nice American. I turned around and said, "Who in hell are you?" You know. And so I come home and had to wash my mouth out with soap because we were supposed to be real nice to these people. Anyhow, Huck progressed into his drinking and I progressed into my sickness. I yelled, I screamed, I hollered, I beat my son. My daughter was so scared of me that she lived in her bedroom. I'm a big woman. And, you know, you get it's bad enough to have a little woman yelling and screaming, but you get somebody as big as a horse yelling and screaming, that's scary. And my poor daughter, she ended up in her bedroom most of the time. And she was scared to come out. And so as I progressed into my illness there, you could buy liquor there. You ordered it, and it would be delivered just like milk. And every week there would be gin and wine and champagne. And this was a weekly deal. This would come besides beer. There would be a case of a liter beer that would come every week. And I would begin to resent the fact because we were struggling to have food on the table. But there was always alcohol in the refrigerator. And I became sicker and sicker, and I became so obsessed with his alcoholism and his drinking and what he was doing, I was losing me as an individual. And I had gotten to the point, and I can remember sitting, come in and sat down in a chair, and it was just like it happened yesterday. And I sat there and I thought, it really isn't worth it. It isn't worth any part of it. And I got up and I went into the bathroom. My kids had left to go on a trip on an army post. They always have a youth center. And they had set up a trip for the kids to go on. And I sat there and I thought, well, this is a good time. Nobody will be here. And by the time they get back, it'll be all over with. So I went into the bathroom and poured everything that said poison in it. It was the worst looking mess you ever saw. Thank God I didn't drink it, but it was awful. And I was about to drink that when my two kids come bursting through the door yelling, "Mama, Mama." And I resented the fact that they were there. I really wanted to go. I was tired of what I was living in. I had walked away from church. I blamed God for all of my problems. Here I was, this good kid, you know, staying home, taking care of kids, washing, ironing, cooking, and you allow all of this to go on. And so I was really upset with him, and I walked away from him for a long time. And when my kids came in the door, and they kept saying, "Mama, we got to talk to you." And I said, "Okay." So I poured everything down the toilet and flushed it down, and I came out, and they said, "Well, we didn't go on the trip, but they having something this afternoon. Can we go?" And I said, "Yes." And then the thought was, why in hell didn't I wait till this afternoon? You know, they'd be gone. But anyhow, the thing is that that was my bottom. I had gone down as far as I could possibly go, and the only way was up. I went back to church. I still was having the problems with me because I didn't understand the alcoholic. I didn't understand why he was drinking, and he was never there when I needed him. He was either passed out or at the bar at the officers' club, and it was always something, and I was alone, and I felt being put upon. And so I finally decided to go back to church, and I went back to church, and I took my kids with me, and I began to listen, and I began to feel that maybe there was something that for me and the kids, that I didn't have to go down to the point of suicide again, that I could get better. So I kept going to church, and then we came back to the States. And when we came back to the States, it was the same old deal of bills that weren't getting paid. The liquor bills were higher and higher. He owed everybody, and I didn't know what we were going to do. We came back in 54, and we was sent to, we were at the language school, and he was club officer there, and you know, that was great. He could do everything he wanted to there, and it was free liquor, so he had a ball. And then we went from there to Fort Huachuca, Arizona, which is a beautiful post, and I could have lived there forever. And he was club officer there. And you're only supposed to go into Mexico once a month. He would sneak in our Prieta, and then he'd go further down to another little town and sneak off and bring back liquor, because it was only, I think, $1.50 for old granddad, and that's what he drank. And so each time that this happened, I would get very depressed, because I could see the money going out and nothing for the kids. They didn't have clothes, and I was building all of these hates and hurts and resentments until I became a pretty sick individual. And we went back in 59 to Europe again, to Augsburg. And when we were in Augsburg, began to become, I told him before we left, I said, you know, if you drink like you did before, I'm coming home. And I think it went one ear and out the other. I don't think he really ever listened to me. And so in 59 we went over again, and he was, 59, it was in 60 that he went over again, and he started in his drinking. And I woke up one morning and I said, we had December, now I know, because 59, 60, 61, and December of 60. Oh, it's hard, you know, when you get as old as I am, you don't know if you're coming or going. And anyhow, in 60, he went back over again, and he started drinking and drinking and drinking. And then December came, and there was no money for gifts for my daughter. And the girl that lived across the hall, her father was in the government. He was in the CIA or something that had to do with that. And, of course, she had everything that there was to be had. And I didn't know what to do for my daughter because I had no money. We had to take out a loan of $1,000 before we left the States to pay all of the bills that he owed. And that had to be. And so that meant there was a certain amount of our pay going back there to the States. And so I sat down. I thought, what am I going to do for Kathy? I really didn't know. And I was looking through my closet one day, and I found a sheet. Don't tell me God isn't in our lives when we don't even know it. I found a sheet. And I sat, pulled it out, and looked at it, and it was brand new. It had never been opened. And I'm not a sewer. I can't sew a straight seam. I never had been. And I thought, maybe, just maybe I can do something with this. And she had a little old robe that I took apart and pulled apart. And I used those pieces. They came up above her knee and up to here on her arms. So I just cut them out, and I lengthened them, and I widened them, and I lengthened that thing and made a pattern. And that thing went together just like somebody knew what they were doing. And that was her Christmas present. He had bought me a sewing machine. Like I said, I couldn't sew, but it had all of these fancy stitches on it. So I stitched all of the fancy stitches on that thing and made it real pretty. And so she was able then to have something, but it wasn't an all like the girl across the way. And I know she felt very left out, and she felt very bad, because when you have a friend that has everything and you have nothing, that hurt her. And so that was in December. And in January, I woke up one morning and I said to him, I'm going home. It's the first time I ever told him I would leave him. And that was after 20 years of living with him as an alcoholic, as an active alcoholic. And I said, I'm going home. And he said, you can't leave me. And I said, but I am. I am. I woke up this morning, and I was the first time I had been quiet within myself, the first time that I had felt like there was a light at the end of the tunnel. And when he said he couldn't do it, I couldn't do it, I said, but I am. So I asked him to start my papers, and he would have to go to the colonel and get the papers and fill them out and whatnot to send me home. I had asked my daughter, now my son had gone into the Navy, because before we left, he and his father was going to have a fight on the lawn. And I said, oh, no, you don't. I said, there's not going to be any violence in my home. Up until then, I was slamming doors and banging dishes and throwing things, but there was no violence in our house. And so I asked him if he wanted to go into Navy, and he said yes, because he had said he did. So he went down and got the papers and went into the Navy, and that was just before we left to go to Augsburg. And that was the best, that was a release to me, because he always seemed to be the bone of contention between his father and I. And he was never lived up to his father's expectation, and I was always beating the bejeepers out of him because he wasn't. You know, this kid really was an abused child. And so I came over, and then when I told him I was going home, he said, you can't. So for 2 weeks, he kept putting me off and putting me off. And finally I said, I'm going in to see Colonel Hall. I will ask him to get the papers started. Well, then he knew that there was no more rationalizing, that I was really going home. So I went in. I said to him, if you don't have the papers when you come home tomorrow — he was officer of the day and they get off at noon the next day — I said, if you don't have my papers, then I'm going in. So he came home. And God works in strange ways. The night before, he had some coffee urns that were, well, the kids have had the AA meeting, were taking the coffee urns, and he didn't want to know where they were going, because he was signed out for them, and if they got lost, then it came out of his paycheck. So he said, where are you going? And I said, oh, we've got an AA meeting over here. And he said, why don't you come over? And he said, oh, yeah, sure, sure, sure. Up until that time, the young man that had started the group over there knew that Huck was an alcoholic, and they were trying to see if they couldn't get him to a meeting. And so then he said, oh, sure, sure. Well, that night, usually they're out of there, but they'd have from 8 to 9. By the time they were out of there, he went by, and they were still waiting at 10 o'clock for him. At 10 o'clock, they had their meeting. That was his first AA meeting. And Dell, the young man, said, I want to go back to talk to you at the office, Huck. And so he went back, and every excuse he made, Dell pulled apart. So when he came home on Wednesday afternoon, he walked in and very quietly said to me, Peg, if I try, will you stay? And I said, yes, if you try, I will stay. Now, he didn't say he was going to stay sober. He didn't promise he would stay sober. He said, if I try. And how can you not ask somebody if they're going to try? You have to give them that chance. So I did. And I thank God I did, because he went into AA over there. And then one day I had a knock on my door, and there were three ladies standing there, and I said, "Yes, may I help you?" And this one girl says, "I'm Ann, and my husband's in AA, and this is Shirley, her husband's in AA." I don't remember the other girl's name. But she said that we would like to come in and talk to you. And I said, "Oh, all right." You know, I had this wall up already. And they came in, and she began to tell me what Al-Anon was all about. And they said, "We would like you, our husbands are in AA, we would like you to come to our meeting." And I said, okay, since Huck was trying, I would try. And I went to their meeting, and their first meeting they were talking about alcoholism and how it was a family disease and how I was as sick as my husband. Woo! The wall went out, you know. I don't drink. I'm this good kid that stays home and takes care of everything. How can I be sick? I'm not sick. And so the next day Ann called me and said, "Well, did you like the meeting?" And I said, "Well, it's all right." And being a New Englander, you know, you kind of stuff things in your mouth. You don't really say what you think. You shove them under the carpet. And the next day she called me for the next meeting, and I went. And then they began to explain for themselves how they were sicker. I couldn't see that at first. But today I can tell you where I was far sicker than my husband. Much, much sicker than my husband. He drank to be sick. I went down mentally and physically. And it was a long road back. And I went to the meetings over there. And then we came just before we left over there. My husband slipped and messed his hip up, and so they wouldn't keep him there if the recovery was more than 6 months, and his was. They sent him here, and he went into Letterman General in San Francisco, and he was there for 8 months. They put a new plate in his hip, and I was running back and forth to the hospital. And even at that, I would take it one day at a time. I was going to meetings here in the States, and I always remembered that one day. That was such a beautiful thing to be able to grab hold of. It's just all I had was to take one day and live it, and to be able to make my life some type of serenity during that day, if it was possible. And so I worked the steps. And then after he had his hip fixed later on, he had to go back, and he had fistulas, and he had rheumatoid arthritis. This man paid a million times over for his alcoholism, for the pain that he had. And with his fistulas, he was up there again for 6 months, and I was going back and forth to San Francisco. And I was working at the time. I had to work because his pension was not enough to be able to live on at that time. And I was in my 50s, girls, and that's not easy. You come back and you have to go to work. And I worked for the county of Santa Clara. I went into it working in the alcohol program. And that was a great thing for me. I learned a lot. I learned to have compassion for those kids that came in there. I learned that they had to learn to have to want to, and I had to learn not to push. I had to learn to be able to use my Al-Anon program with every individual that I talked to. And this program has really taught me. I learned the first step that says that I was powerless over people, places, and things. And if no one wanted to go to a recovery house, I would say, okay, it was that simple. If within my own life there was something I had to accept, I did. I think that's one of the biggest words in our program is the word accept. once I would accept, then things were easier for me. And I learned to do that. I learned to use and apply the steps, the second step, when it said that there's a power greater than myself that could restore me to sanity. That was great. I was so insane all the time. To be able to find any place that I could find sanity was great. So I learned to do that, and it was hard. I think that's one of the hardest things that people have to do, is learn to let go and let God take care of it without taking it back. And how I did that was, my son was in the service. He'd had 10 years in there, and he jumped ship with some woman that had 3 kids and went back to Chicago. Of course, I didn't know where he was, but I walked the floor night and day, because I didn't know where he was. I didn't know if he was dead or alive. I had no idea what happened to him. And so I had to learn to apply the program, to be able to go in my house. I have a picture of Christ, and he's sitting with his hands like this. And I would go and tuck all of my problems within those hands. I still do today. And if I get to a point where I begin to squirrel cage, I'll go back and put my hands on that picture and say, God, you've got it, and I can walk away with it with peace of mind. That's how I learned to release and let go and let God. And to this day, I can do that. Where before I used to have to walk back and stand there and say, God, he's in your hands, today I don't have to. I can simply say it, and he's there. And my daughter's there. My grandchildren are there. Whatever the problems are, I can put them in those hands, and I have peace of mind and serenity. Because when I can do nothing about it personally, then I have to turn to the higher power, and he's with me every single day. When I found the second, wait a minute, I'm getting dry. Thank you. The second step said that there's this power, and when I finally found that power, that was great. Then it said, admit to myself and to another individual the exact nature of my wrongs. That was rough. I had to learn the how of the program. I had to be honest. I had to be open-minded to be able to really listen to what was being said. And the willingness to change. After lying for so many years, covering up for my husband, covering up for myself, I can remember back one day, this was in Germany, and I was in the bedroom, and I was so frustrated. I was pounding on my bedroom door just as hard as I could pound. Now, that goes into the next apartment. And I'm sure that woman probably thought, who in hell's trying to knock the wall down? Because that's what I was doing, just as hard as I could hit it. And about an hour later, I was going out, and she come out, and I put on this other face. Well, good morning, how are you, and how are you feeling, and that's what I did. I had two faces. I had one at home, and I had one when I stepped out my door. I don't anymore. What you see is what you get. You may not like it, but that's your problem. And I've learned that in this program, that I don't have to be for something, that I don't have to. And it brought mine to me way back when I was very young. I heard a poem that I used all the time. Don't be what you ain't, just be what you is. Because if you is not what you am, then you am not what you is. And that has been with me for a lot of years, and I've used it in this program to be able to find my honesty. And today I don't have to lie. I don't have to tell tales. I can sit in a meeting and I can tell you people how I feel, and I don't have to feel bad about that. I don't have to shove it under the rug any longer. I can be able to tell you what's going on in my life if I'm hurting, because that's where I take my problems, is to my meetings and to my sponsor. And I have a sponsor too. She's been in the program about 45 years, and she's a great gal. And if I get to the point where I'm real upset, then I will call her. There's not many times I can do that. And somebody was saying, you can't ever get a hold of your sponsor. Well, she travels, so very seldom I get her. I'll send her a card, say, well, I needed to talk to you, but it's okay now. And I send her the letter, But it's through the 12 steps that I was able to find my higher power. When I got to that, searching and fill this moral inventory of the fourth step, that hurt, because I had to go back and admit all of my wrongs that I did in all of the time that we were living together. And do you know, when I really got honest with me, I found that most problems within my home was not my husband. It was me and my big mouth. And I had to admit that. I had to learn that I had to stick my fist in my mouth and keep it shut. I didn't have to react. I no longer had to prove a point. I no longer had to say, hey, that isn't what I said. I would say, if that's what you think I said, okay. You know, I agree with whatever you said. If the moon was blue, fine. Then I go ahead and do my thing. I just didn't argue. And then he got to the point where he lost a leg, and he was in a wheelchair through his arthritis. And those were very trying times, because I had to really pull on this program when you have somebody that you're working with, and for 15 years he was in the chair, and that you have to take care of him, and you do it without being upset and without being mad, knowing that you're kind of tied to, you know, a space. And then one day I said, look, I have to get out of here for a while. So I said, what I'm going to do is have somebody come in and stay with you, and I'm going to a conference. The conferences were my out. Every time there was a conference, I would have somebody come and stay with him. And then I would go, I would leave Friday, I'd be gone Saturday, I'd come home Sunday so filled with love and care of having been in a conference that it was great. I brought all of that back with me. And I came back with a whole new attitude. I had to get away for a while. And I did that every time there was a conference. And then I would say to him, would you like to go? No. And then the one we had at Squaw Valley, I said, would you like to go? No. I said, okay. Then I said, I'll get some of the girls and we'll go. So I had four girls all lined up to go with me 3 days before we go. He said, I think I'm going with you. And I said, what am I going to do about all of these girls, honey? They're going too. So I got on the phone, and we managed to find rides with everybody and rooms. And so it worked out. Instead of getting mad and upset and blowing my mind, I got on the phone, and we really worked it out, and it was great. And that's what this program can do if you don't allow yourself to go off the deep end. Five, admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. That was hard for me, because that again was like your fourth step of being honest and saying what my part was in what we did and how it all happened with it. I hung everything on Hutt's hook, you know, his alcoholic hook. Everything was his fault. God, his hook must have been as big as this place, because everything was on it. But you see, I learned in Al-Anon that that wasn't true, that I had to be honest. And then we're entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. I didn't even know I had defects of character. Oh, God, I've got a bucket full. And I still haven't got over a lot of them. But I'm aware of them, and I'm trying to change them. And that's the one thing that I try to do every single. If I become aware of something I do, I know that I shouldn't do, then I have to say, okay, Peg, this is something you have to work on. Seven, humbly ask him to remove our shortcomings. And I thought, oh Lord, it's bad enough having one without having two. You know, defects of character were bad enough, but shortcomings are even worse. And I said to my husband one time, he said to me, Peg, is there something that I do that bothers the hell out of you? And I said, yeah, honey, why? He says, what do I do? And I said, when I'm reading and you're reading, you always say, Peg, listen to this. And I said, you're reading to me, and I go back and I've read the same paragraph four times and still don't know what I've read because you're reading to me. He said, I didn't realize I was doing that. He said, I'll try to be better. And I said, well, why did you ask? He says, because you do something that just... He said, I get so mad at you when you hang things on doorknobs. And I said, Oh, my Lord, honey, I hadn't even realized that. He says, if you see a doorknob and if it hasn't got something on it, you have to put something on it. So I said, I will be careful of that. I won't do that any longer. And today I don't hang on doorknobs. I have learned that lesson. Then it wasn't doorknobs. In putting on with his arthritic hands, he had a hard time undoing tops and things. And I put them on and I'd squeeze them down and put them in the refrigerator. And then he would say to me, damn, honey, don't put them on so tight. Okay, honey, I won't. So then I'd put it just a little bit, then they'd drop and smash, see? So I had to learn to do a little more than just put them on. Okay, I could have rant and raved about that, but I didn't, because I was thinking about him and his hands. And if you think about the other guy, you're not going to get so mad. You're not going to get upset if you really begin to think of what the other fellow is going through. And he went through a lot. And God was great, and when he took him, I was married 39 years to him, and he took him while he was in the hospital. He had to go back up. He had cancer of the throat, and he had to go back. And through all of this, and said, here, first I want to make a list of persons we had harmed and became willing to them all. I made amends to my son. I made amends to my husband and my daughter. And I went to my husband, and I said, honey, I'm sorry for all of the terrible names I called you, for all of the awful things I did. I am really sorry. And he said, hey, it wasn't your fault, it's mine. I said, no, I had a part in it too. He said, but you don't have to. And I said, yes, I do. For me, I have to. For me, I have to make amends so that I can get that out of my way. I apologized for the beatings that I had given my son. And I said, Ernie, I'm so sorry for the terrible way I beat you so much. And he said, I said, you got a lot of them you didn't deserve. And he stopped for a minute and he said, well, Mom, for those that I got that I didn't deserve, made up for the things I did you never caught me at. He tried to wipe the slate clean, but that doesn't do it for me. I know what I did. I can see the black and blue spots, you know. And today, he loves me very much. But at least he tried to make it easier for me. But that doesn't make it easy for me because I did it. I still have guilt for that. I have to work on that constantly. God forgives me. I have to forgive me. And that's very hard to do. Because today, he doesn't like to be around crowds. He's up on an Indian reservation in Northern California. He's married to an Indian girl. He loves it up there. He don't like crowds. And a lot of that is because when he was a kid, he was an outgoing kid, and he has just shut that all off. I've talked to him about his when he was home and young, and he doesn't remember. He doesn't remember. It was too painful, and he has shut it out. I tried to get him to Al-Anon. No, he didn't want to go. And so there wasn't anything I could do about that. My daughter, she went to Alateens while we were in Germany. But when she come back to the States, she only went a couple. And I didn't have a drink either. Went to a couple of meetings, and she says, "Mom, all they do is run around, and they're just not using what Alateen's about." So she never went back, and that's sad because today she still carries a lot of the problems that we had when she was younger. But she is now 48. I can't change that. So that's acceptance. And she has to suffer the results of her own actions, whatever those actions are. And she talks to me little by little. I hear her repeat what I have said. If nothing else, she'll get this program by osmosis, you know. But for me today, I have serenity. For me today, I know if I don't have it, it's nobody's fault but my own. I can't blame somebody else for me being upset or down. It's either because I'm not accepting what somebody is doing or thinking or playing or whatever that I have to say, hey, that's not my 10 acres. That's up to the individual, not me, and I can back off. I put that in God's hands, and lots of people don't have a picture, but get a God box and try a God box. It's great to write out whatever happens and put it in there. And you'll find that it helps you to be able to accept what is. There's things, a lot of things that I haven't talked about that's happened in my life that aren't easy, but this program has helped me to be able to get through it, to have serenity and peace of mind. 4 years ago, I had a colon cancer operation. I went in and they told me I had it, and I said, okay, what do we do about it? And the doctor said, I'll send you to Dr. Mousavi, and we'll see what we can do. And he said, I want you in the hospital on the 15th of February. I said, I can't. I'm burying my sister on the 15th. Then he said, you'll be there on the 16th. And I said, yes, sir. I was there on the 16th. And I went in. I was not upset. I was as calm as I am right at this moment. And I went through this. Finally, some young man came in, and he was talking to me very quietly and telling me what was going to happen. And all of a sudden, it hit me. He was trying to find out. He thought maybe I was going to blow up or something or fall apart. And I said, Doctor, I'm not upset. I'm not scared. Oh, hell, Mrs. Knapp. Mrs. K. Down. And so, my anonymity is broken way back when. from Fresno to up to the I was in there just in service. Get into service, kids. You grow. You would be surprised how you grow. Anyhow, I have to go in on the 2nd. They have found something in the breast. I'm not sure what's going to happen. And whatever it is, we'll take care of it then. And I'm not going to sit here and be upset and cry and fall apart. That's all wasted energy. The whole thing is wasted energy. I'd rather hang on to what I've got, see what the doctor has to say, and we'll take it from there. And whatever will be, will be. And this program will pull me through it. All I've got to do is work the steps. The first one alone says that I am powerless. The only thing I have to have is a good attitude. I like my serenity. I like what I have to work for. I go to meetings. I don't go to as many as I want to. But I am very grateful for being able to go to those that I do. I have one on Tuesday. I have been speaking lately, and I found one over off of Willow that's a nice one. I might pop in on that occasionally. I can't night drive anymore, so my home meeting on Highland Avenue is out. I may try to get somebody to drop me off and then hitch a ride home, but our program tells us we don't depend on everybody, and I don't want to get in the habit of depending on somebody to pick me up and take me somewhere. That's my problem. That's something that I have to figure out for me. And so for today, I have a lot of serenity. I wish I could give each and every one of you what I have. Now, we talked about years. I called my sponsor because she lives in Oklahoma. That's the same lady that was in Germany that told me I was sick. But we are very close. We've kept in touch all these years. And I called her and I said, when did we start to meet? When did the meeting in Augsburg start? I said, in 1960? No, she said, it was 61. I said, oh, damn, I've lost a year. So I want to tell you about my years. I don't want you to get caught up in them. Years are just because I have grown one day older, 1 year older, and I go to Al-Anon. And those years behind me don't mean a tinker's darn if I blow the program today. Those are nothing. It's what I'm doing today that really counts. And that's the way I live my life. I don't get caught up in those years behind me. The only reason I'm there is because I'm older than all of you. I'm 79. And, you know, and if you keep going, by the time you're 79, you don't have that many meetings behind you, too. But it's not to get caught up in my years. It's nice to have them. I've learned the by being and going that long and all these years, I have learned more and more, and I still learn today. And I try to listen when I'm in a meeting, and I try to gain from something that somebody says. And just because I've been doesn't mean I have all the answers. I never will have all of the answers. But for me today, the serenity I have, I am very grateful to everybody that's been in Al-Anon, because you are the people that have given it to me over a period of years. Wherever I've gone, I have always come home feeling real high from an Al-Anon meeting. So keep coming back. It's very important that you listen and learn. That's great. We have so many slogans in this program that really helps us over the humps if we'll use them. And it's using them that really helps us. So with that, I'm going to shut up. I'm on my soapbox again.
Thank you.
Thank you.